Hello there. This is another episode of A to Zig. This is episode D, Democracy Defined. And I'm Ziggy Kazicki, your host here for today's program. American democracy is under threat. And there's no doubt that this program is inspired by all the people who really don't believe in democracy. So if I can start by just giving us a good idea of what democracy is, you know, this comes from the Oxford University Dictionary, so if somebody's going to question this, take it up with them. But it's a system of government governed in such a way that a majority rules, and it's a state-governed system, which means that there's actually legitimate, lawful interests involved in forming a democracy. And it's formed and practiced by principles, you know, these principles of social equality, which sometimes I think gets lost even in a democracy. You know, as I look around America today and I think, well, we should all be looking at each other as equals, that's not happening. And so, you know, you just can see by looking around that democracy is being challenged by any person who thinks that we're not all equal. But we're not new at this. In fact, it was Benjamin Franklin, a scholar in his day, a politician, a scientist, an entrepreneur, a journalist, a man about the world, who basically said after the Constitution of the United States was ratified that, you know, we can have a republic if we can keep it. And he meant that. He meant that it's not forever. It's something that really requires attention. Democratic republics are not merely founded upon the consent of people. They also are dependent on active and informed involvement. And for people to continue to show interest in democracy. America is a republic that was built to preserve a system of self-governance and individual liberty. And people really like that individual liberty part. In fact, they think that that's really what democracy is. But that's the benefit of a democracy. It isn't necessarily an entitlement that we can all expect if there is no democracy. So where did this whole democratic thing start? It was the Greeks, and in particular Aristotle. And if you haven't written anything about democracy, you may not have been asked to actually look at the origins of democracy. But Aristotle was the father of democracy way back in about 384 BC. So that's a long time ago. He was a philosopher, logician, scientist, science. He was a man who understood evidence and worked with this whole concept of democracy being something that could be formed. He regarded democracy as being necessary for successful communities, successful government. And as long as people actually upheld democracy, the Greek states and the Greek Empire, as it was, really manifested a great deal of control over the world during that time. But as it started to fall apart, as monarchy replaced democracy, it fell apart as a political system and eventually disappeared. And the Greek hold on the world disappeared with it. Now, there was another group of people who liked what the Greeks did, the Romans in particular, and they established a democracy in Rome. And it actually lasted until Roman monarchy overthrew it in 509 BC. And while it was a democracy, it was probably a pretty good place in the world to be. But as it became less of a democracy, it started to fall apart. The concepts that made living in the Roman Empire, being a Roman citizen, disappeared and were replaced by many of the kinds of things that, when we look back at Rome, were an example of the kind of behavior that we shouldn't see again. Well, the Roman Republic was ancient, and for many people, 753 BCE seems like a long time ago. But the Republic functioned effectively until there was a civil war. And once that took place, the Republic fell apart. And we know that there were some remnants of it. And you might think, well, why are you talking about the Greeks? Why are you talking about the Romans? It's because other people read what the philosophers, the Greek philosophers wrote, studied the Roman Empire, and eventually rose up and said, hey, we should have a democracy. And the Magna Carta, which really is the foundation for modern democracy, was signed by the King of England, King John, in 1215, after many of the lords and people said, we can't have this kind of feudal world. We don't want monarchy to rule us. Let us have something else. It was a significant document. It evolved into civil rights. And that's one of the things that comes with democracy. If you have civil rights, it's because of democracy. If you remove democracy, your civil rights go with it. These two things are really paired together. And so this was the first document of human freedom. Up until the Magna Carta, we really didn't have this kind of document. It was recreated again in the United States in the form of the U.S. Constitution. And the U.S. Constitution became the supreme law of the United States. It still is. And even if you look around today, you see that people are challenging it and questioning whether it applies to their everyday behavior. But the preamble of the U.S. Constitution really kind of lays out why it was put together. And maybe you haven't paid attention to it, or maybe you read it once and you threw it away. But listen to this. We the people, that's us, of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. Now, you hear politicians say that, for instance, in the state of the state address that the president of the United States issues, he says to form a more perfect union. In other words, he's going back and saying to do what the Constitution asked me to do, to form a more perfect union, establish justice. That's where the rule of law comes in. Ensure domestic tranquility. That's where the law is actually put into practice, so there is tranquility. Provide for the common defense, and this means against both threats in the United States and threats outside the United States. Promote the general welfare. That means for all of us to have, you know, a good life. Secure the blessings of liberty. That's that freedom thing, the blessings of liberty. Freedom to speak, freedom to write, freedom to do many of the things that we take for granted, which if you go around the world is not necessarily a given. And to do it for ourselves, but also into posterity, for our children, our grandchildren, the next generation. And we ordain and establish the Constitution for the United States of America for these purposes. Now, there are many elements in that Constitution, but that's the preamble. That's why we have one. And you might think, okay, great. That's nice. I'm really happy we have it. And why should I care? Because if you look at this particular graph here, you'll see that democracies don't exist everywhere. The green countries on this world map have some form of democracy. And there are many forms of democracy, some that are truly strongly embedded in this idea of what Aristotle and others talked about and promoted, and what the founding fathers promoted in the preamble, and some that, you know, kind of straddle it to some degree. But you can see that democracies also didn't always exist. If you look at the green in this chart, you can see that it's grown over time. And somewhere after, the 1800s, it started to grow worldwide. Now, it doesn't mean that all countries will have democracy either. Obviously, there are less and less countries that are pushing against democracy, but even now we see that there's an incursion into democracy by autocracies that are being formed around us. And there's people who actually in the United States would like to see democracy go away and an autocracy, a dictatorship, a king, replace it, because they think that might be easier to live in. Obviously, if you look around, there are some drawbacks to that. So why is American democracy under threat? And it is under threat. And what exactly is the threat? Well, there's probably a number of ways that we could look at this, but there's probably four main threats to democracy. And these are always there. And sometimes they come and go depending on the people in the United States or in a democracy. In other words, this is what Franklin was talking about. He was talking about the idea that democracy, if you can keep it. And the first threat to democracy has to do with election theft. Somebody actually steals the results of an election. In this country, we've done a very good job of making sure that elections are fair and honest. And the number of threats to it are really small because we have 50 states all working very hard to make sure that election integrity takes place. And even though a lot of people might think that there's unfair elections, we have some of the most watched and fair elections anywhere in the world. And the last election, for instance, was probably the most scrutinized election. And after all that scrutiny, there was no theft, you know, despite the fact that some people might say there was. There's the threat of minority rule. Now, going back to what we said about democracies, it's a majority rule endeavor. And the minority, whoever they might be, can try to overcome that. And one of the quickest ways they can do that is to get rid of elections or to have less people vote. And in the process, they can actually assume power by turning out their minority to vote while the majority doesn't turn out their majority to vote. And so elections are really key to whether or not democracy continues. And you might think, well, what's the matter with a minority being in charge of a democracy? It immediately slips into becoming an autocracy, because a minority will then use all the power at its disposal to make sure the majority does not have a chance to assume power. And, you know, that's creating a dictator or a king in some regard. And, you know, you might think, well, what's the matter with that? You know, when I look at the dollar bill, I see George Washington on it. George could have been a king. In fact, they wanted him to stay on. But George, if you know anything about George, first of all, didn't want to be president. And then when he was elected the first time, thought that was it. And he got talked into a second term because there was so much wrangling and instability. But he was done after two terms. He didn't want to be a king. He could have stayed on until he died. But he understood what happens when you have a king. You lose democracy. And he didn't want that to happen. So he set the example of, you know, you serve your time and you move on. You don't consolidate power and stay in that seat forever. And you give people a chance to vote for somebody else. So one of the things I mentioned was the threat to voter, and usually that comes in the form of suppression. Voter suppression can be done in a number of different ways. The first way that it usually gets done is to make people believe that their vote doesn't count, that it's insignificant, that even if they vote, people are going to ignore their vote. If that was the case, why do politicians spend hundreds of millions of dollars to get people to vote? Obviously, your vote counts, and it's important for people to vote. And we have in modern elections seen voting go up and down. What I think we need to keep in mind is that voting is one way that we reaffirm democracy. And when we don't vote, we really start to see the erosion of democracy. The other threat to democracy is an irresponsible political party. And we've had many irresponsible political parties over time. And most of them have disappeared, mostly because they're irresponsible. In the modern age, we've had two major policy-making political parties. And then we've had some other minor policy-making political parties. And political parties, when they become irresponsible, typically start to lose the majority because people realize they're not representing the majority. Political parties that have the majority probably spend a great deal of time looking at what does the majority need? What does the majority want? How can we serve the majority? It's a simple rule. Give the majority what they want. And the reward is they typically get reelected. And many of the majority policies then get adopted, and that reaffirms the political party. It's a very simple concept. If you're a minority policy political organization, you probably end up losing, unless, of course, you do something to change the way elections are held or make it harder for the majority to actually have a say in policy. So one of the things that we saw in this country was that many people didn't have the right to vote. And even though it said that they had the right to vote, we had things like Jim Crow laws in the South that really made it hard for people to vote. Back in 1965, this President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Voting Rights Act. Why did we do that? It outlawed the discriminatory voting practices adopted by many Southern states after the Civil War, including literacy tests and other prerequisites for voting. Think about this. You're going into a voting place, and somebody's got a jar of jelly beans or just beans sitting on a tabletop, and it says, "You gonna vote?" "Yeah." "Well, you can't vote until you can tell me how many beans are in the jar. Or you can't vote until you read this document." And if you couldn't guess the number of beans in a jar, you couldn't vote. And you think, well, that's crazy. Now, that's what Jim Crow laws and the suppression of vote did in the South. And the 1965 Civil Rights Act actually stopped those things from happening. So even though we are a democracy, within a democracy, we can see people, a minority of people in this case, trying to suppress the vote. The 26th Amendment of the United States Constitution in 1971, that wasn't that long ago, established a national standard, a minimum age of 18 for participating in state and local elections. It was proposed by Congress and passed by a vote of Congress and the people. So we've established some rules about voting, and 18 was picked as a date because it was really assumed that people needed to have an understanding, an adult understanding of what they're voting for. So in the last election, 2020, 66.8% of the voting population voted in the last presidential election. Now, that seems like a low number to some people and seems like a high number to other people, depending on where you're looking at this. Obviously, it could be higher, and there are countries where it's much higher than 66%. But what it really points out is that, you know, there's a 40-plus percent of the population that does not vote for whatever reason. And if we really wanted to have a vibrant democracy, we need to get that 40% to be more actively involved. So voting is a really important part of keeping a democracy intact. When voting starts to decrease, a democracy starts to dissolve. So in this next election, for instance, it'll be interesting to see if it's higher than 66%. If it's less than that, then maybe democracy is starting to wane. Well, getting back to Benjamin Franklin and this whole idea of democracy, when they were forming the Constitution, when they were looking at how to create a democracy, after it had been under the control of a king, had been under the control of a monarch, had essentially been an autocracy, and after they rebelled against it and won that privilege, Franklin, who was in his day probably a sage and a scholar, really was asked, well, what do you think about government? What do you think about what's going on? Will we have a successful democracy? And he was a good judge of character and said, when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all of their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. And what he really painted in that description was that democracy is messy. Democracy isn't always, you know, an easy process. It requires an awful lot of jostling. And so when we look at our modern democracy and we see these things playing out, we should expect it. We should know that democracy requires that to happen. Why? Because it allows even people with prejudices, even people who have made mistakes in judgment or are not making decisions based on facts or are selfish or only thinking about their local interest or their selfish views, it gives them a chance to speak out. And in that process, what we hope will happen is that the prevailing decision-making will be to support the best interest of the majority. And that's how a democracy should work. So we shouldn't expect it to be, you know, one person decides to do something and it's done. You know, only I can fix it is a really treacherous way of thinking about government. You know, what we should be really concerned about is if there isn't these kind of conflicts, if people aren't involved in these kinds of debates and these considerations, what are they doing? Are they really practicing democracy? And what we should expect is that the wisdom, the joint wisdom, will win out eventually, and the decisions that are made will be in the best interest of the majority. So, you know, in looking at democracy, and I think we all should look at it as something that is a series of decisions made across many generations, and it's an ongoing process. We should always look at it as something that needs our input, our voice, our involvement. And the simplest way to do that is to vote. But before you vote, to actually become informed, to spend some time looking at the issues, spend some time looking at the candidates, and then ask yourself, of these people who are out there, who best represents me and my interests? Who best represents me and my community's interests? Who best represents me and my state and country's interest? And who best represents the future of democracy? Those are the kinds of things that have to take place. And if you have an allegiance to a party and you feel that you're always going to vote for that party, put that aside for a few minutes, because parties can change their philosophy, they can change their purpose, they can change what they think is their role, and we have to always align ourselves with the practices and policies of political groups that are really going to represent our majority interest, because that's how you keep a majority from disappearing, and also that's how you keep a republic, a democracy, continuing. Remember, a democracy is only something that will continue if we want to keep it. If we decide to push it aside, Franklin's thoughts early on when the Constitution was formed will come back to haunt us. It's a republic if you can keep it. It's a democracy if you can keep it. And if you're not interested in keeping it, it will disappear. And it will be replaced by the kind of autocracies that replaced the Greek, the Roman, the feudal lords, you know, will take over the modern feudal lords will govern, and the freedoms that we enjoy, the prosperity that we enjoy, all those things that go into making a perfect union will disappear. And we don't want that to happen. So make sure that you decide to vote this year. Make sure you look very carefully at what the candidates' positions are. And also, don't go into it with a bias. Be open-minded. Think about this as being another election. And in a democracy, you don't have to vote like you did last time. You have the freedom to make a choice. And make a choice. Thank you so much for listening to the things I've shared here, for watching A to Z. There are other A to Z programs, which you can find on YouTube. And I appreciate the fact that you're interested in learning more about how we can all make this a better world. Thank you so much.